We're very pleased and honoured to have Professor Andrew Pettigrew as the final speaker for the Early Modern Seminar for this term. He's a professor from St Andrews, I'm sure you're aware, and I'm sure you're very familiar with his work on the Reformation, and his wonderful recent book on the book in the Renaissance. So he's going to speak to us today, I think, about the exciting new short title catalogue and his new project on the news. So we're looking forward to hearing about this. Thanks.
Thank you. In 1712, the English author Daniel Defoe was the author of a new commercial venture, an innovative publication which he named the New Review. This was a serial publication issued two or three times a week, consisting of a single essay spread over four pages. And it allowed Defoe to offer his reflections on the political issues of the day and other themes of national interest. On one occasion, Defoe turned his attention to his own world, of journalism, pamphlets, and news. The present times, he wrote, had seen a media explosion. He recalled a time, even in his own lifetime, when there had been no such torrent of newspapers, state papers, and political writings. The rage for news was transforming society, and Defoe was happy to be in the thick of it. Now, Defoe was not the only one to remark the current passion for news and the rancorous tone of political debate that seemed to come with it. Jürgen Habermas built his theory of the emergence of the public sphere around the coffeehouse culture of London in this epoch. But if Defoe, or indeed Habermas, truly thought this information culture was new, he was very much mistaken. There's always been a tendency to notice something for the first time in England and think that this was new, something I first noticed among historians of the Reformation many years ago. In fact, Europe had had a healthy market for news going back at least to the beginning of the 16th century. This certainly predated the invention of the newspaper at the beginning of the 17th century, and in fact, the newspaper struggled to make its way into the established network of news. One of the themes emerging in my new work is how little a part the newspaper played in the culture of news. What struck Defoe was the new range and intensity of the market for printed news. Of course, Defoe was far from a disinterested party. After several false starts, he was now trained to make a career as a political journalist, and it was very much in his interest to persuade his readers that they were living through a new age. Reading Defoe, I was reminded of a conference now some years ago when representatives of various academic presses tried to convince a room full of sceptical academics that the CD-ROM was an inescapable part of our future. One, a lady from OUP, was particularly impatient with us. The truth was that OUP had invested very heavily in this technology, and they needed to convince us that our sad old books were destined for the scrap heap. Well, 15 years on, the CD-ROM has come and gone, as has the lady from OUP, while books sail on. As the invention of print demonstrated in the 15th century, any attempt to predict the future impact of new technologies has to be treated with scepticism, particularly when these predictions come from interested parties. Print did have a transforming effect, though not in the way its first boosters, many of them humanist scholars who wanted to build their own libraries, not in the way they had expected. The ventures that the humanists promoted lost money. What made money and saved the new industry was cheap print, produced in volume, swiftly, and quickly dispersed to a local market. And an important part of this new world of cheap print was the market for news. Now, my purpose today is to sketch how the new genres of printed news impacted on existing news markets. This work will draw heavily on the data we assembled for our first global survey of early printing, the Universal Short Title Catalogue. It was the work of preparing this resource which first sensitized me to the overwhelming importance of cheap print. We have a subject search here, and that shows the search for news books which you can make, and I think it's just under 10,000 hits. It brought into the existing news market the capacity to spread news beyond the existing groups in medieval society who shared and traded news. The new commercial news market vastly expanded but also greatly complicated the existing networks of information exchange. How effectively they serve to create an informed public is something we need to investigate. So what I'm going to say today will have three parts. Briefly, I will sketch the established networks of news before print, and I'll then come on to describe how the new world of print impacted on this environment. I will conclude by looking at one 16th century news event and try and determine the various roles of different media in that. First then, news before print. At some level, everyone has access to news, even if it's only the news that your neighbour's roof is leaking, or their chickens have ceased laying, or that a local thug has been captured and will face trial. News, rumour, gossip and storytelling were essential, if often brutal, aspects of life in any pre-industrial community. It's fair to say, however, that this is not generally what these societies meant by news. When people asked travellers what news, they meant news from afar. They overwhelmingly understood this to be events of political, military or economic importance. And this was certainly what news meant to those to whom it was a vital commodity in medieval Europe, those in positions of power. Those most active in the medieval news markets can generally be identified as members of one of three main communities of power: the church, the governing classes, and the elites of the international merchant community. The first to establish functioning news networks were church institutions. As an international organisation, the church had the clearest necessity to keep in touch. Also, through pilgrims crisscrossing the continent, the church had a natural infrastructure of messengers. For Europe's medieval rulers, it was far more difficult. They had the need for reliable channels of information, both to make their wishes known to their subjects and to gather intelligence from places abroad. But the expense of establishing a functioning infrastructure to meet these purposes was very considerable, even crippling. So while most rulers, and that included the governors of independent city-states as well as princes, while most of them employed messengers or heralds to carry their information, they also gladly availed themselves of what information could be gathered up for free. And most of this came from Europe's international merchant community. By the 14th and 15th centuries, intricate networks of trade had grown up between Europe's major markets, around the Mediterranean, across the Alps, between Italy and Northern Europe. And this led to a new sort of news communication. Among the governing classes, the habit persisted of sending confidential messages with a trusted envoy. The written communication would often be little more than the credentials of the bearer. The bearer would be left to communicate the news themselves. Now, for merchants trading abroad, this was simply not possible anymore. Here, instructions or news of trading conditions at home and abroad would have to be spelled out in full. The merchant communities were also the first to establish regular postal services between the major nodal points of the trading network, travelling usually weekly and with remarkable reliability, with considerable volumes of mail. The news of faraway events, often of real commercial sensitivity, was then often openly shared in the market square. There's an interesting convention among merchants that news should be freely shared. In some places, incoming merchant letters were publicly read to the whole community. In this way, a very substantial information nexus was established throughout Europe before the invention of printing. This period also established principles of news publication that would prove remarkably enduring. Those in the market for news, I think, were concerned with three main things. Firstly, they worried about the reliability of news. How could they know that what they had been told was true? Secondly, they were aware that speed was of the essence. Policymakers and those with thousands invested in perilous ventures, merchants, needed to know what was going on as soon as possible. And thirdly, they recognised that knowledge was power. Rulers were increasingly aware that it was an important part of the art of government to control what their people knew, to accentuate the positive and to play down bad news. These news values, inherited from medieval Europe, would prove remarkably enduring. And to these three principles, truth, speed and control, the news market of the print era added only one more, and that was entertainment. If publishers were to make money from news, they had to produce something that matched up to the other claims on their clients' limited disposable income. Why should they spend their money on a printed news pamphlet rather than a work of imaginative literature, for instance, or the gossip available down at the tavern, or a trip to a stage play? And this need for news to be commercial considerably complicates and sometimes cuts across our other three principles, as we shall see. Now, I would say in the first age of print, publishers were very slow to react to what we now see as the revolutionary potential of printing. The technological genius of print was not matched by a similarly innovative approach to subject matter. Indeed, as I've suggested elsewhere, not, it must be said, always to wild applause from incunabulists, this slavish regard for the intellectual priorities of humanist scholars at one point seemed likely to shipwreck the whole enterprise. The salvation of the new technology would ultimately lie in the recognition that cheap print, that is, small works published for a local audience, provided the necessary turnover to sustain a totally new business model. In due course, news publications would form as essential part of this market, but not in the first decades of printing. The discovery of cheap print was largely due, in the first instance, to the mechanisation of the routine business of the late medieval church, most notably in the production of indulgence certificates. This is an indulgence certificate dating from the very first days. This is by Gutenberg. These and the associated pamphlets and sermons that accompanied indulgence campaigns had a not inconsiderable news function. They explained why it was that pious donations should be given, often to fuel campaigns against the Turk or other crusades. I think Falk Eisermann, who's the scholar of this early ephemera, is right to refer to these coordinated campaigns of preaching and publishing as a true media event. With the sheer volume of business generated, they showed the way towards a more purely commercial news market. Now, in the 15th century, such news publications were rare. A small number of pamphlets celebrated the successful defence of Rhodes in 1480. In 1492, Sebastian Brand published a series of illustrated broadsheets, and this is one, recording a large meteor that had fallen in Alsace. And unfortunately, this is very decayed, but you can probably see better the illustration here, and here's the meteor about to plummet to the ground. But the real development of a new market in print was only accomplished in the 16th century, and here Germany led the way. It was German newsmen who invented a new type of newsbook, the Neue Zeitung. This was not, as the word might suggest, a newspaper. Although Zeitung has now become the German word for newspaper, this is a change of sense from its 16th century meaning. Zeitung derives from an earlier Middle German word, Zeitung, which is closer to the Dutch Tijdung or English tiding. Neue Zeitung is therefore best translated as new tidings or a new report. So interestingly, etymologically, the word Zeitung on its own does not carry the same resonance of novelty or newness as the word, English word news or the French nouvelle. And this raises the interesting issue of whether a report has to be of recent events in order for 16th century readers to regard it as news. Now, the Neue Zeitung was usually comparatively brief and almost invariably a single continuous piece of prose, usually devoted to a single news report. This marks it out from the more varied digest of news presented in the Merchant Correspondence or in the manuscript newsletters that would be the true ancestors of the newspaper. So these Neue Zeitungen can't be regarded as the forerunners of the newspaper. Because they were devoted to a single issue, they provided the opportunity to inform the public in some depth about the great issues of the moment. And they first appear on the market in the first decade of the 16th century. The first one I've seen dates from 1509. But they remain comparatively rare until the 1530s. My view is that this is for largely commercial reasons. In Germany, the Luther affair had so overwhelmed interest in other types of news that printers had little reason to seek alternative markets. It's the middle decades of the century that the news pamphlets first came into their own. In form and presentation, they're remarkably similar to the Reformation Flugschriften, almost without exception, published in the quarto format with a text of 4 or 8 pages. So this is one of the religious pamphlets, and the news pamphlets follow this form almost exactly. In the news pamphlets, the front cover would be decorated sometimes with a woodcut illustration, but this was generally a generic battle scene, scarcely ever cut for a particular title. And these texts were not costly to produce. A quarto of 4 or 8 pages was a single day's work for even a relatively small print shop. An edition of 500 or 600 copies could be out on the street within a day or two of the printer obtaining the text. And what we found is that this Reformation work in the 1520s reintroduced printing into about 40 different German cities, where it had died out since the incunabular age. Now, these news pamphlets proved immensely popular, both with the buying public and with producers. Printers could make very good money from a very limited outlay. Pamphlets of this sort offered far more rapid returns than substantial books, especially as most of the print run could be disposed of locally. And one can easily see why publishers were so eager to feed an appetite for news whetted by the Reformation. We never really know how many of these news pamphlets appeared on the market in the course of the 16th century. These were little works intended to be read, passed around, and then discarded. They're very different from the sorts of books published for prolonged consultation or to dignify the shelves of a library. And the paradox we face for the 16th century is the surviving evidence, that is, books that have lasted, are often the very least read. That's the reason they survive. So many thousands of these news pamphlets have no doubt disappeared altogether. So it is quite remarkable that about 4,000 of these German news books have survived. And this represents a substantial proportion of the total output of German books during the 16th century. The overwhelming proportion of the Neue Zeitungen deal with high politics, usually foreign affairs. The first survivor of 1509 is a report of the French-Italian wars. The second, from 1510, reports the reconciliation of the French king and the Pope. Over the century as a whole, the largest proportion published in Germany were devoted to chronicling the engagement and campaign against the Turk on land and sea. The land war in particular was very close to home for the German city-states. At various times, the seemingly inexorable progress of Turkish arms seemed to threaten to envelop the eastern Habsburg kingdoms and threaten markets in which German merchants had important investments. So pamphlets that promised to tell readers, and I quote, how the Turks have made a new incursion into Croatia and the castles and lands they have taken, these were bound to find an eager, if anxious, audience. And that's a not untypical title for such a book. Now, the Neue Zeitungen were generally rather sober and restrained in tone. The title pages took pains to emphasise that these reports came from authentic, trustworthy sources. This was the issue of trust. Often they reproduced verbatim a dispatch which they said had been written by a captain from the camp or scene of battle. Very often they declared that their text was, quote, received from a trustworthy person, or reproduced a letter sent from abroad, quote, to a good friend in Germany. In these ways, I think the news pamphlets invoked the trust reposed in correspondence between two friends, as a confidential medium between two friends of repute, to bolster the credentials of a publication that was now commercially and generally available. In keeping with these principles, the news pamphlets are also generally careful to avoid sensationalism. The titles are far more likely to emphasise that a dispatch is reliable or trustworthy than shocking or astonishing. And that sort of reporting is left to other parts of this increasingly diverse news market. The market for news pamphlets was not confined to Germany. The Low Countries, as we see here, were another important news hub. And what I've tried to do is I listed the number of news pamphlets we know and then expressed that as a proportion of the total vernacular output of those various parts of Europe. And then by way of reference, just given the total number of total for the 16th century in each column. The Low Countries, as I say, were another important news hub, and a significant number were also published in England. Many of these were straightforward translations from news from France or the Low Countries. But as we see, it's very much a phenomenon of Northern Europe. It required really large events, such as the victory of Lepanto, to stir Italian publishers to a significant output of news pamphlets. The Italian peninsula, to this point the hub of the European news market, was in this respect beginning to diverge from the North European norm. The German pamphlets were unique in their success in establishing such brand identity. No other print tradition developed anything to match the Neue Zeitung as a way of advertising the work. These were the first publications in the new era of print to acknowledge on their title pages that the bringing of news of current events was their primary purpose. They shared this news, often of faraway events, with a broad and expanding public and at modest price. Now, battles and the deeds of the great were by no means the whole of the news agenda. Printers also seized the opportunity to share news of floods, earthquakes, and destructive fires, celestial apparitions, and notorious crimes. But these, I have to say, though they've attracted a lot of attention, are not particularly common in the news pamphlets. They found a far more natural home in the ballad sheets and illustrated broadsheets that also began to impact at this time on the news market, and it's to these I'll now turn. Now, reconstructing this part of the news market is especially challenging, made all the more so by the astonishing decision of the Falde Sechsen, the German National Bibliography, to exclude single sheet items. Now, this is a unique decision. It's unique to Germany, and it's unique to the 16th century because the Inkinabida include broadsheets, and so did the German 17th century bibliography. But this is their own little idiosyncrasy. It means, for instance, that the 95 Theses in its original German broadsheet version doesn't appear in the German National Bibliography, even though it's one of the foundational documents of German society. But rules are rules, especially in Germany. Now, our Universal Short Title Catalogue has made some attempt to repair this deficiency, partly, I think, just to spur the Germans on to do it themselves. And we've got online with a representative sample of about 3,500 German broadsheet items. And a substantial number were news sheets. These beautifully crafted artefacts were eminently collectible, but even so are often very rare, and we would be very poorly supplied were it not for the creative eccentricity of one remarkable contemporary collector, Johann Jakob Wick. Now, Wick began collecting soon after his appointment to a position at the Zurich Cathedral in 1557. From 1560 until his death in 1588, he filled one fat volume a year with reports of great and startling events from Switzerland and beyond. Partly these were his manuscript writings, the things people told him, with many handsome watercolour illustrations. And interleaved with these a large number of printed items, some 500 pamphlets and 400 broadsheets. Now, the broadsheets in the Vick collection are almost invariably conform to a standard form. Invariably, the top half is given over to a woodcut illustration with a heading and then with an explanatory text below. And many of them, rather like this one, are written in verse. What I want to just draw to your attention is the typological similarity with the Reformation broadsheets of the day. Heading, illustration, verse. And it's clear that the news sheets were heavily influenced stylistically by the Reformation movement, just as the pamphlets were. Now, stylistically, the illustrations fall into three groups. Some, the smallest number, presents a woodcut of a single dramatic moment in the narrative, as here, the tale of an apprentice who murdered a 10-year-old girl and dismembered the body. The woodcut shows the perpetrator surrounded by body parts. It's an arresting image, although here a little crudely done. More often, the woodcut presented several scenes from the drama in a sequence that scrolls around the landscape, from the crime scene here to the place of execution there. So this is an imagined narrative. And this format was well known to the medieval world from the passion narratives of late medieval painting, and was particularly well adapted to crime reporting, where the cruelty of the mode of execution was matched to the shocking nature of the crime. A variation of this narrative form was to have the drama broken up into separate scenes in the manner of a strip cartoon. And one crime that we find represented in both ways is the shocking case of Blasius Endres, who, on discovering that his wife was stealing money from him, murdered her and their six young children. This was a crime committed about 150 miles north of Zurich, and one of these broadsheets was printed in Lindau, the other in Augsburg. So news of these crimes travels quite widely. Now, not all the broadsheets dealt with gruesome crimes and exemplary justice. Also popular were unusual animals and what were known in the unforgiving terminology of the time as monstrous births, human or animal. These were described in woodcut illustrations of some care, and in the case of conjoined twins, a degree of accuracy which makes the particular cases quite recognisable to modern medical science. An interesting subgroup which have particularly interested me spoke to the particular fears of a society which could easily be plunged by extreme weather or harvest failure into crises of subsistence. A number of these broadsheets offer careful renderings of fecund sheaves of grain, here with an improbable 77 ears of corn. And at least four broadsheets tell tales of miraculous deliverance when it rained corn. But by far the greatest number of the illustrated broadsheets that survive deal with heavenly apparitions. And this introduces a very interesting element into our discussion of news. Because I think most of us would probably think that our 16th century forebears were by and large here describing events which did not happen. Heavenly portents were an overwhelming preoccupation of the 16th century, and this extended from the interpretation of comets and meteors to reports of a flaming cross or armed horsemen seen in the sky. Many people came to Vic to tell him these stories, and they're very often rendered in these broadsheets. And the popularity of this genre is an important reminder of the theological and cosmographical context into which all news reporting had to be aligned. With these news pamphlets and broadsheets, we've now described a range of works that make up the something like 10,000 items that in the USDC we've described as news. But we should also acknowledge that this falls far short of the total volume of print that fulfills some form of news function. And here I want to mention two other of our categories in our classification scheme, official ordinances and polemical texts. With the arrival of cheap print and the first news pamphlets, Europe's rulers asked themselves an important question. Could print be used not only to inform, but to persuade their subjects? Could print become a powerful instrument for explaining policy and shaping public opinion? The French Wars in Italy brought about an enormous and creative use of print as a means of harnessing public support for a potentially hazardous venture. Each stage of the French descent in Italy was accompanied by news pamphlets published back in Paris explaining the French victories and the great joy with which they were greeted by the Italians they had liberated. But there were dangers here. Princes were keen to publicise their victories, treaties in which they met their strategic objectives, ceremonial entries and dynastic marriages, and all these were subject of news publications. They were less keen to share with their subjects news of military reverses. In the vicious and sustained conflict between Francis I of France and the Emperor Charles V, news of defeats would be published only by the gloating victor. This is a little news pamphlet I found in Rouen. It's in one of the most terrible years of the war for the French. I think it's 1544. And yet they still find a sort of minor skirmish which they can publicise to cheer up their local readers. Now, the problem with this concentration only on victory, is one wonders how useful it would have been to merchants, for instance, anxious to know whether goods could safely be consigned to the roads. They have to know bad news. It's therefore not surprising that this era, in which polemical news pamphleting became common, was accompanied by the growth of a commercial, confidential manuscript news service available to those who could pay on a subscription basis. Now, this was really the core of the commercial news market in the 16th century. It has nothing to do with print. I've just brought one example here from the Fugger newsletter in Vienna. And what you can see is that it's very different in form from the news pamphlets. Instead of being a single story, it's a succession of news items in very short clip paragraphs, no comment whatsoever, bare facts, dated, in this case, that it's arrived from Antwerp. This state-sponsored polemic I've described was an important weapon, but it was only effective when the state maintained a monopoly, or at least reasonable control of the local press. In the second half of the century, when this control breaks down, we see an enormous increase in confrontational polemical accounts of current events, particularly so in the Dutch Revolt and the French Wars of Religion. Here, reports of battles, sieges, and executions were gleefully exploited either by Catholic or Protestant. This is an example I've taken of a French royal edict, and I put it up here to show how important official print was to provincial printing in places like France. A very, very indifferent printer who can scarcely print a line straight, who was kept afloat by relaying royal instructions from the capital to a provincial audience. The vast proportion of official print was far more mundane. The practice inaugurated by Maximilian I of printing up official ordinances was willingly adopted by other rulers. And we count something like 22,000 of these official edicts and proclamations in the USTC. And when we've completed our survey of German broadsheets, the number will grow still further. This is an edict of Bavaria, 1538. Most were intended to bring to the notice of the population new regulations on taxation, price regulation, and the regulation of markets, on the raising of troops, or a warning against seditious talks and actions. But in addition to articulating the citizens' new responsibilities, most of these official orders also had some sort of explanation of why the legislation was necessary. They would lead with a preamble which normally stated that it had been necessary to introduce this legislation because
the inhabitants had asked for it or because there was a war coming up. And the consequence of this is it very, very often only reaches the sort of real importance of it, here's what you must do, some way down the sheet. And this, for this reason, broadsheets are extremely difficult bibliographically to catalogue, which is one reason why it hasn't been done, because they don't have a title page.
By far the greatest collection of such official print is in the Museum Plantin Moretus in Antwerp, for although Plantin, seen here, is celebrated as one of the great printers of the 16th century, he was also very happy to act as an official printer for the prevailing local authority, whoever that might be. For a period of about 20 years, he turned out a mass of regulation for the local town council, and he very helpfully, to us, kept a file copy of everything he printed. And it's an extraordinary resource for the activities of an early modern government, and here's an example. I've been to Antwerp many times, and the most touching of these things that I found there was a little notice with a blank for the name. And it said, the bearer of this notice, blank, to be filled in, is to leave Antwerp within 24 hours. And you can imagine this being handed over to a vagrant or pinned on them while they were drunk. But it does imply an expectation that these people might be able either to understand it or someone would read it to them. It's a very interesting use of print for the lowest reaches of society. Well, what have we got? We've got about 10,000 newsprints, we've got 22,000 edicts, we've got 8,500 polemical pamphlets. They're all told about 40,000 editions and perhaps 20 million printed copies. What impact would all this printed news have on 16th century consciousness? So I want to end by placing all this newsprint in context by investigating a single news event. And I've chosen the Spanish Armada, partly because this is a very long, drawn-out event and particularly testing to report. People were desperate to know what was going on, and it was by no means easy to find out. The fleet that King Philip of Spain had dispatched to England in 1588 was intended to resolve a whole complex of interrelated problems. The revolt in the Netherlands, which had descended into a stalemate, and was no closer to resolution than 15 years before. His interests in France. So everybody knew that on this expedition to conquer England rested a whole lot of important European issues. It's obviously impossible that an enterprise of this sort could be kept secret. And in fact, the English knew what Philip had in store for them from at least 1587. But once the Armada set sail, Europe entered a period of anxious waiting. While the fleet made its way north, Europe's information centres experienced the equivalent of a news blackout. Such snippets as were picked up by passing vessels and returning seamen often turned out to be wildly inaccurate. Even from the point that the Spanish flotilla was sighted in the channel, it would be several weeks before its success or failure was determined. The Armada campaign was thus quite different from the joyful announcement of the victory of Lepanto or the thunderclap of the St. Bartholomew's Day massacre, both also important news events. The Armada campaign was a rolling news event which occupied most of an anxious summer, where hard news was scarce and rumour, uncertain reports and speculation filled the vacuum. The Armada, which left Lisbon at the end of May, soon encountered foul weather and was forced to take refuge in the North Spanish port of Carana. It set out again only at the end of July. The decisive action took place on the 7th and 8th of August. Having kept his fleet intact on the passage to the Channel, Medina Sidonia anchored off Calais to await the juncture with Palmer's army, and the army of invasion was to be carried across the Channel. And it's here, as we know, that the English fleet made its decisive move, sending in fireships to force the Spanish ships to scatter. Driven north by strong winds, the Armada headed ever further from the proposed rendezvous. By the end of August, there was no hope of return. Now, for those far from any action, this was a difficult period, and nowhere was news more eagerly awaited than in Rome. The Pope had committed himself heavily to Spanish success, promising Philip a contribution of 1 million ducats once Spanish troops disembarked on English soil. So Spanish agents in the city were keen to announce the victory that would release this very enormous sum. The Spanish postmaster, Antonio de Tasso, was heavily engaged in promoting every positive rumour. The manuscript newsletter, known as the Aviso, of 30th of August, reported that Tasso had wagered heavily that he would have good news by the 20th of August, in 1 week's time, a rumour deliberately planted to sway the markets. The snippets picked up by merchant networks could also be misleading. In July, a merchant was exhibiting in Rome letters from Lyon reporting that the Catholic army had arrived in Scotland and was disembarking there. The commercial newsletters, the Avisi, actually equipped themselves very well in the Armada campaign. Even then, though they're under tremendous pressure to give their readers good news, they report the rumours of Spanish success, but noted always that these were unconfirmed reports. On the 16th of July, the Pinelli bankers received word from France announcing a Spanish triumph, but, notes the Aviso, because there is such great desire to believe in a victory, it's necessary to wait for confirmation. Good advice. The patent scepticism and professionalism of the Roma Visi did not prevent news of the Spanish victory being wildly celebrated in Catholic Europe. A large part of the responsibility for this information rests with the Spanish ambassador in Paris, Mendoza, who received and then circulated a sequence of highly misleading reports. At the end of July, news reached Paris of the battle off the Isle of Wight. 15 English ships were said to have been sunk. So Mendoza sent this news straight to Madrid and made arrangements for an account of the Spanish victory to be published in Paris. The English ambassador Stafford countered with his own chronology of events, laying out the course of the battle, including the decisive engagement of the 8th of August. And this was published in French in Paris, though interestingly no respectable Paris printer would allow his name to be associated with the English propaganda. Mendoza was unimpressed. Quote, "The English ambassador has had some fancy news printed stating the English have been victorious." This is what he writes to Philip. "But the people would not allow it to be sold, as they say it is all lies." Instead, he chose to share with Philip a more optimistic report that Medina Sidonia had worsted and captured Sir Francis Drake. Now, Mendoza's first report arrived in Madrid on the 8th of August. When the second came on the 26th, Philip was prepared to declare victory. He had it announced by a printed broadsheet, unusually for him. Elsewhere, it's the same story. On the 17th of August, the Senate of Venice voted to convey their congratulations to the king on his great victory. On the 20th of August in Prague, the Spanish ambassador ordered a Te Deum to be sung in celebration. But just then, news came in with contradictory reports. In Rome, it was left to the Avisi, the manuscript commercial news sheets, to prick the bubble of wishful thinking as the true extent of the Spanish defeat emerged, beyond the capacity for even the most optimistic to wish away. Well, what are the protagonists? England, its treasury bare after 3 years of war from the Netherlands, had staked everything on the success of the navy. Although the English government was now finally appraised of the essential pivot of Philip's grand design, the juncture of the Armada with Parma's army, the precise point where the enemy's main force would land was still unknown. Elizabeth believed they would attack through Essex or sail up the Thames, and so the county forces were instructed to muster at Brentwood. For all the money spent on Walsingham's intelligence service, around 5% of the Crown's annual revenues, it had not been able to determine that the invasion force was aimed at Kent. Certainly, it was a close-run thing. By driving the Armada away from Calais before Palmer's troops could embark, the English navy had exploited the weakest point in Philip's plan. By the time Elizabeth travelled down the river to address her forces gathered at Tilbury in Essex, where indeed they would have been badly out of place had the invasion taken place, the Armada had actually already passed the Forth of Firth, heading northwards. So Elizabeth could tell her subjects, and she had the heart of an Englishman in fairly safe circumstances. In Spain, the full scale of the disaster only gradually became clear. A defensive dispatch from the Duke of Parma, admitting that the juncture with the Armada fleet had not taken place, arrived in Madrid on 31st of August. 4 days later, a courier from France brought news of the fleet's flight northward. Not surprisingly, there was little appetite in the king's inner circle to convey this news to Philip, and they left it to a fairly junior official who made rather a hash of it. Instead of going in to see him, he wrote him a letter comparing this to other great defeats suffered by very noble rulers. Well, to the victor, the spoils. The defeat of the Spanish Armada provided an opportunity for a great wave of celebratory pamphleting in England, the Netherlands, and Germany. The vanquished licked their wounds in silence. The presses of Italy, so busy after Lepanto, had little to offer, and France was consumed by its own affairs. Now, England had been badly shaken by the events of the summer, but as the scale of the victory became known, all was forgiven. The Queen's speech at Tilbury was witnessed by a number of aspiring authors keen to perpetuate its memory. Two agile and enterprising entrepreneurs returned hot foot to London and registered ballads celebrating this speech the very next day. Clear? Clear?
Yeah.
Where's that?
That's it.
Thank you.
There's Tilbury. These Tilbury ballads were part of a cascade of cheap prints, as London's often underemployed printers cashed in on the mood of national celebration. And I should say, in relation to survival, we really do lack a Jacob Vic in England, because of the ballads registered, only about 10% survive in an extant copy. James Aske, whose Elizabetha Triumphans was an altogether more ambitious literary work, at one point despaired of seeing it printed at all. He said, quote, because of the commonness of ballads. With the danger now past, it was time to mock recent fears. It was widely reported that on board the captured Spanish ships had been found large numbers of whips and leg irons, clearly to enslave and torment the conquered English. And this was cheerfully satirised in a blood-curdling ballad illustrated with woodcuts of the whips. Now, one of the most subtle pieces of government-sponsored propaganda was an English version of a Spanish pamphlet listing the ships, munitions of men and the Armada. The original, printed at the time of the fleet's embarkation in Lisbon, had been republished in French by Mendoza during the summer. Now, England threw back in his face the battle array of the invincible army, of the invincible fleet, vanquished by England's mariners and God's will. All told, I think, we can see a new confidence, wit, and polemical flair in the English pamphlet literature of these years, epitomised by this, a pack of Spanish lies, a typographically subtle piece that presented the Spanish plains of the summer in a ponderous Gothic type, alongside a collective narrative in a sprightly Roman. Now, what's interesting about this, of course, is that Gothic type lasts far longer in England than it does in Spain. So it's a reversal of the typographical reality. But it seems to be saying, we are the future now. Thus was false news held up to ridicule. At the beginning of a decade when news of continental wars would consume the London press, England's printers were taking significant steps towards the development of the fully fledged news market that had eluded them up to this point. Well, what insights does this brief narrative offer of the nature of 16th century news culture? What I think we see overall is that it is the role of print is seldom to bring the first news, certainly not to those in positions of power and influence. They would use their manuscripts, commercial news services. Even the general population was more likely to have the first intimation of great events through word of mouth, proclaimed in the market square, or the swift passage of rumour as people were alerted to momentous events by the passage of troops, the ringing of bells, or the lighting of bonfires. Those who could afford them relied heavily on the commercial manuscript news sheets, though these too, as we can see with the Armada, were tested in such polemically charged times. Print, newsprint, functions more as a means of processing known events, providing added detail, suggesting lessons to be drawn, or just plain straightforward gloating. I think the relationship is not that much different from that between the newspaper and the broadcast media today. Although I still read a daily newspaper, I find little in it that I don't already know from listening to the news incessantly during the day. Sometimes it provides me with background information. More often it provides me with arguments or justifications for opinions I already hold. I came from a family where my parents were of a conservative disposition, and on the issues of the day, particularly during the Thatcher era, when they were troubled by events, I find I could get more of a rise out of them by getting to them before the Daily Telegraph arrived in the house, and their courage had been reinforced by what they read in their own paper. I think, in the same way, our 16th century forebears had a similarly sophisticated appreciation of different aspects of news. They too had understood print as the opportunity to build a multimedia news world. And for those who took the opportunity to serve them for it, it became richly profitable. Thank you very much.